The confession was supposed to close it. In January of 1989, 3 days before he was executed in Florida's electric chair, Theodore Robert Bundy sat across from investigators and described in careful clinical detail how he had killed at least 30 women across 7 states. He named them by name. He described the locations. He described, with what investigators later said was unsettling precision, the physical conditions of the scenes. He did all of this not because he felt remorse. Every forensic psychologist who studied Bundy agreed he felt nothing close to remorse, but because he had learned that information was currency, and he spent the last of his in those final 72 hours. Laura Ann Aim was one of the names he spoke. She was 17 years old on the night of October 31, 1974, a Thursday, when she left a Halloween party in American Fork, Utah, and began the short walk home. The Wasatch Mountains rose east of her in the darkness. The temperature had dropped to the low 40s. She was last seen at approximately 11:30 at night on State Street, about a mile from her family's home. Her body was found 26 days later by hikers at the base of Mount Timpanogos, in the foothills of the Wasatch Range, on Thanksgiving Day. She had been beaten. She had been strangled. She had been left in a place where the mountain held her. And the investigation that followed her death spent years gathering what evidence the terrain and the time had left behind. Theodore Bundy was arrested in August of 1975, eventually convicted, eventually sentenced to death in Florida. He confessed to Laura Ann Ames' murder. He confessed to at least 30 murders in total, though investigators have long believed the actual number was significantly higher, possibly as many as 100. The confessions came with details that matched crime scene evidence. They were documented, they were recorded, and yet the forensic record from Laura Ann Ames' case, the biological evidence collected in 1974, preserved in the Utah Cold Case Archives across 5 decades, was never definitively matched to Theodore Bundy by DNA analysis until April of 2026. On Wednesday, April 1st, the Utah Department of Public Safety announced that DNA testing conducted on evidence from Laura Ann Ames' case had produced a conclusive match to a DNA sample from Theodore Bundy held in the National Criminal Database, 52 years after her death, 37 years after Bundy's execution, 1 week after what would have been Laura Ann Ames' 69th birthday. The investigators who delivered this result to her surviving family described it as a confirmation of what was already known. Bundy had confessed. The case was technically solved. The DNA match was, in their framing, closure. But closure is not the same as documentation, and documentation is not the same as understanding, and understanding is not the same as justice. What the gap between Theodore Bundy's confession and today's DNA confirmation actually reveals is something the public conversation about Bundy has consistently avoided. That for the 40-plus years between his execution and this announcement, the forensic files of at least some of his victims existed in a state of administrative ambiguity, acknowledged in confession, archived in evidence, but never submitted to the molecular confirmation that modern forensic science could have provided much earlier. The question that sits inside that gap is not about Bundy. Bundy is decades dead. The question is about what the criminal justice system chooses to do. And when, and for whom, with the evidence that remains after conviction. Theodore Bundy killed in at least 7 states: Washington, Oregon, Utah, Colorado, Idaho, Florida, and possibly others. His victims were primarily young white women, predominantly college students, in their late teens and early 20s. He was charismatic, educated, intermittently employed in Republican Party politics in Washington state. He was, by every external measure, invisible as a predator for years. His method was consistent. He used a Volkswagen Beetle. He wore a fake arm cast, or walked on crutches, or dropped items near his car and asked women to help him carry them. He was described by survivors as handsome and unthreatening. He was convicted of murder twice in Florida and received 2 death sentences. He escaped from custody twice. He killed again after escaping. Laura Ann Aim was his fifth documented Utah victim in a three-month killing surge that ran from July through October of 1974. He killed Melissa Smith, the 17-year-old daughter of the Midvale police chief, 9 days before he killed Laura Ann Aim. He killed Deborah Kent, 18, just 21 days after. These were not isolated incidents. They were a sequence, and the investigators working the cases in Utah in 1974 were, for more than a year, hunting a killer they could not identify because the patterns that seem obvious in retrospect were not obvious in 1974, before the concept of the organized serial killer had been formally developed as an investigative category by the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit. The FBI's development of criminal profiling as a discipline, now central to how law enforcement approaches multiple homicide cases, was itself partially informed by the Ted Bundy case, Ann Burgess, and Robert Ressler's foundational research on serial killers in the late 1970s, included Bundy as a primary subject. In this specific and strange way, Laura Ann Aim's murder contributed, decades later, to the tools that might have found her killer sooner. Applied retroactively to cases that came after, the tape that Bundy left across his crime scenes was never entirely silence. He was a man who, in his final hours, spoke to investigators, not to help them, but to perform a version of himself he found satisfying. The brilliant, complex, studied perpetrator, whose cooperation was a gift rather than an obligation. The confessions were accurate in their details, because inaccuracy would have undermined the performance. He wanted to be believed. He wanted to be remembered as the man who could explain himself. What he did not account for in those 3 days before the electric chair was that the biological material he left at crime scenes across seven states would outlast his narrative, that the molecules would remain when the performance was over, that 52 years later, in a forensic laboratory in Utah, a match would be confirmed with a certainty that required nothing from Theodore Bundy at all. The Cold Case Archive is not a neutral institution. Evidence in cold cases is preserved inconsistently, tested inconsistently, and prioritized inconsistently. The resources that flow toward cold case DNA review tend to follow public attention, advocacy, and the administrative decisions of individual agencies about what constitutes a worthwhile investment of lab time and budget. Some families wait decades. Some evidence degrades. Some cases are never submitted for modern testing because the agency that holds the files has not been asked, or has not prioritized, or does not have the funding. Laura Ann Aim's family waited 52 years. The DNA confirmation issued in April 2026 does not change what happened to their daughter. It does not change the known perpetrator. It does not alter the legal record, which has listed Theodore Bundy as her murderer since his confessions were entered into the case file before his execution. What it changes is the category of certainty, from confessional documentation to molecular fact. For the investigators who work this confirmation, that distinction matters. For a family that has lived with a known answer for 37 years, the practical weight of that distinction is harder to measure. What the confirmation does is make the question of the archive impossible to avoid. If DNA testing of this evidence was technically achievable for at least the last 15 years, given the development of sensitive STR and SNP analysis techniques capable of working with degraded biological material, why did it take until 2026? The answer is not a single failure. It is the ordinary accumulation of underfunded cold case units, administrative workflows, evidence storage decisions made by agencies, navigating budget constraints and competing priorities, and the fact that a case with a confession from a dead perpetrator is not, in any agency's triage system, the most urgent use of limited forensic resources. Laura Ann Aim deserved the certainty of the molecules. So did Melissa Smith. So did Deborah Kent. So did every woman in the archive who is still waiting. Theodore Bundy told investigators everything he wanted them to know about who he was. What DNA analysis does is remove his voice from the record entirely and replace it with something he could not perform, the physical fact of what he did. in the language that does not allow for charisma or narrative management or the theater of cooperation. The tape always runs out eventually. The molecules do not. The question for the families, the agencies, and the archive: how many of the others are still waiting for the confirmation that the confession was never enough to provide? And what would it take to get through them all?